developing, but across these areas there will be some heavy downpours for the afternoon, particularly affecting northern Pennine areas, with some torrential bursts of rain expected here through the afternoon from slow-moving thunderstorms. Now, both for Northern Ireland and for Scotland, after a wet start to the morning, we'll start to see some heavy downpours develop, and again, these showers will be thundery in nature, slow-moving as well, bringing some locally large rainfall totals, a risk of some localised flooding from the heaviest of the downpours, and temperatures of around 20 to 21 degrees Celsius. That's the weather. It's back to Jim.
Thank you, Chris. Now we continue to work through the year in our book of the week, 1913 by Florian Illies, a sketchbook of Europe under the shadow of war using biographical extracts and contemporary news stories.
Spring Awakening. On the 8th of March, in Vienna's Café Imperial, Frank Wedekind, Adolf Loos, Franz Werfel and Karl Krauss meet for an early coffee. In Paris, Marcel Proust pulls his fur over his nightshirt and goes back into the street in the middle of the night. He stares for 2 whole hours at the St. Anne portal of the Cathedral of Notre Dame. The next morning he writes, "For 8 centuries on that portal, a much more charming humanity has been assembled than the one with which we rub shoulders." On the 3rd of April, Franz Kafka declares himself to be ill beyond recovery. He writes to his friend Max Brod, "I keep imagining, for example, that I'm lying stretched out on the floor, cut up like a joint of meat, and am slowly pushing the pieces of flesh towards a dog in the corner. Thoughts like these are my mind's daily fuel." Things can't continue like this. His friends are worried, and Kafka himself is genuinely afraid he's going mad. He is hardly sleeping and has headaches and major digestion problems. He can't write anymore. All he can manage are his letters to Felice in Berlin. Even that has become more difficult ever since his idealized image of his lover from her letters became flesh and blood, since he trembled with despair beside her when they met in Berlin. He's at his wit's end. But Kafka doesn't go to see a doctor. He turns to self-therapy instead. He calls by at the Dvorsky Market Garden in the working-class suburb of Nussel and offers his help with the weeding. Rarely has he made such a wise decision as this. He is given a choice between flowers and vegetables. Of course, Kafka chooses the vegetables. He begins on the 7th of April in the late afternoon, once he's finished his work at the insurance company. We don't know how often he went to the gardens. We only know why he fled at the end of April. The gardener's daughter had drawn him into her confidence, prompting these thoughts. "I was forced to listen to the story of how the young woman's brother, whose name was Jan, poisoned himself with melancholy 2 months ago at the age of 28. So the very place where he was seeking to be healed from his inner suffering came with a threat of fatal melancholy. Distraught, Kafka leaves the gardens on the Nussel slopes. No sanctuary to be found anywhere. On the 30th of April, Frank Wedekind's play Lulu is banned by the censors. Thomas Mann, who has just been elected as a member of the Munich Censorship Council, gives it a positive review, but he is outvoted. 15 out of 23 council members vote for the play to be banned on moral grounds. Out of protest, Mann resigns from the council. 4 Picasso. As always, when a new lover comes along, life and art are transformed completely. In Eva, he seems to have seen the opportunity to become bourgeois, to get away, at least a little, from the bohemianism that was keeping him from working. And so they both move from Montmartre to Montparnasse, where the new Line 12 of the Paris Metro happened to go. While Montmartre remains the place for the penurious artists, the opium smokers and the prostitutes, Montparnasse is becoming the new haunt of the successful players in the Paris creative industry. In the words of the impresario Apollinaire, in Montparnasse you find the real artists dressed in the American style. Some of them might dip their noses in cocaine, but no matter. When Picasso and Eva first met, they had escaped to Serret in the Pyrenees, and in the spring they did so again. Picasso wants to flee the city and its art scene so he can finally get some work done. In Serret they rent the Maison Delcroix and prepare to stay there till autumn. He sends two cheerful postcards to his most important patrons, his art dealer Kahnweiler, with whom he had signed a lucrative exclusive contract, which means that for the first time he is earning proper money, and he writes to Gertrude Stein, who had done a lot of work in the background to ensure that Picasso was shown in the Armory show in February. The postcard to Stein shows three Catalan farmers. In a handwritten caption, Picasso identifies the one with the beard as a portrait of Matisse. Soon Picasso's good mood evaporates, because his father's health is deteriorating. He hurries to Barcelona before going back to bury himself away in his studio in Serret again. He is happy when his slovenly friend Max Jacob comes from Paris. As the painter spends most of his time sitting in his studio stubbornly working away on new possibilities for his papier-collé, the collages of synthetic cubism, Jacob spends most of his time with Eva. As it rains incessantly, they sit inside and sip cocoa and wait until the master has finished his day's work. In the evening they drink wine together. At night, the damp air is filled with frogs and toads and nightingales. But Picasso's thoughts are with his sick father, the father of fathers, who taught him to draw, whom he loves and whom he hates. When he was 16, he had said, "In art, you must kill your father." And now the time has come. Don José dies, and Picasso is paralyzed with grief. But that's not the last of it. That spring, Eva falls seriously ill. She has cancer. And then Fricka, his beloved dog, is on her deathbed. Eva writes to Gertrude Stein, "Fricka can no longer be saved." In the spring of 1913 in Serret, Picasso is having his greatest spiritual crisis. Paul Klee visits Gabriele Munter and Vasily Kandinsky at 36 Einmüllerstrasse, Munich. At the height of their love affair in 1906, Munter and Kandinsky travel together through Italy and France, painting shimmering oil studies of the sea so similar that even today we still don't know which of them painted which. Now, 7 years later, their lives are becoming more separate, as are their styles and, almost, their beds. Kandinsky is drifting away towards his blazingly colourful abstraction, while Munter sticks to her weighty painting, with black lines bordering the colours like the lead in stained-glass windows. That's the style in which she paints Klee when he comes to visit them. A jagged profile, starchy collar, precise moustache, against a backdrop of several Kandinsky and Munter paintings hanging on the walls. Klee is wearing slippers in the portrait. The snow is still thick on the ground that April in Munich, so Klee would probably have got his feet wet as he walked round to see his friends. Comfortably warm now, he tucks his feet into the slippers belonging to the mistress of the house. Perhaps it's that small, friendly gesture that makes him finally give in today when Munter asks, yet again, whether she can paint his portrait. His shoes will take another hour to dry anyway, he may have thought, stoically accepting his fate. And so he gazes out at us from the picture, a lasting legacy of this intimate moment from the private lives of the Blaue Reiter, the Blue Rider. On the 20th of April, Adolf Hitler turns 24. He sits in the men's boarding house at 27 Meldmannstrasse in the working-class neighborhood of Brigittenau, Vienna, painting in the common room. His room is too small to paint in. 500 people have tiny individual cabins there, each containing a bed, a clothes stand, and a mirror. Board costs 50 hellers a night, about 10 old pennies. Anyone who stays there long-term, like Hitler, gets new bedding every Sunday. During the day, most of the residents hang around the city looking for work or distraction, and in the evenings they come streaming back. Only a few stay there during the day, and Hitler is one of those. Day after day he perches by the bay window in the so-called study, where the day's newspapers are kept, sketching and painting watercolours. In the mornings he sketches out the picture with his pencil, in the afternoons he adds the colour. Each evening he gives that day's finished piece to another boarder, asking him to sell it in the city. Most of the paintings go to Kühler, a female art dealer in Hofseiler, in the first district of the city, or to Schlieffer, the junk dealer at 86 Schönbrunnerstrasse. If a scene comes out well, he paints it a dozen times. For the most part, he spends the whole day quietly with his paints. But when the talk turns to politics, he makes impassioned speeches about the immoral state of the world, and of Vienna in particular. "It can't go on," he screams. "There are more Czechs living in Vienna than there are in Prague, more Jews than in Jerusalem, and more Croats than in Zagreb." The April edition of the National Geographic reveals one of the wonders of the world. Machu Picchu, the lost city of the Incas, has been rediscovered by a collaborative expedition between Yale University and the National Geographic Society. The leader of the expedition, Hiram Bingham, takes the very first photographs of the ruins of this magical city suddenly discovered among the high vegetation at the highest heights of Peru. National Geographic dedicates the entire issue to its excavation. The magazine publishes 250 photographs. It declares, "What an extraordinary people the builders must have been to have constructed without steel implements and using only stone hammers and wedges, the wonderful city of refuge on the mountaintop." In the 15th century, when Florence was at its peak and Leonardo was painting the Mona Lisa, Machu Picchu came into being 2,360 meters high up in the Andes. Even today, the rain drainage system in the terrace city works perfectly. Librarian descending a staircase. After successfully completing a course in library studies, Marcel Duchamp takes on the role of library assistant at the Sainte-Geneviève Library in Paris. Despite his tremendous success at the New York Armory Show, he is done with the art world. He begins by staying silent, but the value of Marcel Duchamp's silence hasn't yet been overinflated. No one actually notices. He spends all his time playing chess. Later, he will become a member of the French national chess team and participate in 4 chess Olympiads. There is still no trace of the Mona Lisa. J.P. Morgan, the American financier, receives a letter from a lunatic who signs himself Leonardo and says he knows where the painting is. Morgan's receptionist throws the letter away.
1913, the year before the storm, was written by Florian Illies, bridged by Pete Nichols and read by Michael Maloney. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. BBC Radio 4. Now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Thursday the 25th of July. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, 200 miles west of Rockall, 1002. Expected 150 miles west of Shannon with little change by 1800 Thursday. High, Biscay, 1016, dissipating. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking, north at zero, south at zero. Variable, mainly easterly, 3 or 4, fair, then showers, fog patches, later. Moderate or good, occasionally very poor, later. 40s, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne, Dogger. Variable, becoming east or southeast, 3 or 4, increasing 5 at times. Thundery showers, fog patches, moderate, occasionally very poor. Fisher, German Bight. Variable, 3 or 4, thundery showers, fog patches, moderate or good, occasionally very poor. Humber.